I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everybody. This is Kevin, and welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Tonight, we have Stella Lynn, and we're going to talk about midwifery care, the ins and outs of having a baby at home, and other birth options for new families. So if you are pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant, it's easy to be overwhelmed and unsure about what all of your different choices are, from the type of care provider, ways to nourish a healthy pregnancy, and deciding on the setting for your birth. There are many options and considerations, and these decisions greatly shape the type of pregnancy and birth experience you'll have. Birth is a profound rite of passage, one in which women become mothers, couples become families, and the infant is greatly impacted with foundational impressions about life. So this is very...
It's going to be a fun conversation.
Fun conversation.
Yeah, but before I introduce Stella Lynn and give you a little bit of her bio, I do want to point out this is Stella's second time on our show, and we're talking about a completely different topic. So we're so excited. You're I think, the second person to have actually come back to our show. So yay. Ah. Glad to have you here for a second time.
Thank you.
So let me give you a little bit.
And our first show was on herbs.
On herbs,
and you can find
yeah.
that in the archive on radiofreepalmer.org.
Absolutely. Okay, so a little bit about Stella Lynn. She's a home birth midwife serving the Mat-Su and Anchorage areas, offering families dynamic choices for natural childbirth. She weaves herbal medicine, homeopathy, and nutritional counseling into her individualized care. She sees family health as resting on a foundation of informed, empowered parents. As such, she strives to educate her clients and provide support as a guardian of safe and gentle birth on their turf and their terms. I like that. Wait, one more time. Gentle birth on their turf and their terms. Her practice, Holistic Midwifery, is based out of the Kozlowski Building in downtown Palmer. Go Kozlowski Center. For more information, go to www.holisticmidwifery.com or call 745-6545. Stella does free, no obligation consultation. So welcome to the show, Stella.
Thank you.
All right. So we know this is a passion of Stella's, and we don't really have to say much here, and we'll just let Stella get going. But we did have a question come up before we started, and what is the definition of a midwife? So what does that mean, and what does a midwife do?
Okay. Well, the word midwife comes from the Old English mitwif, M-I-T-W-I-F, and that word means with women. And that really is a good explanation of, or a good description of what a midwife does. It really comes down to the fact that as the care provider for a pregnant and birthing woman, it's about the relationship. It's about building a relationship in the prenatal period and bearing witness to an incredible process, and one that I see bringing women right to their core and right to their edge. And it's a real privilege to get to walk with someone for that journey. A midwife is the primary care provider for a pregnancy, for a woman during her pregnancy. Prenatal care, support, and guidance during labor and birth, and during the what I call the fourth trimester, or the postpartum period. We walk with women through the process, and midwifery care is particularly for low-risk women. So a lot of what we're doing during the prenatal time is just keeping an eye on things and making sure that things are within, quote-unquote, normal range, and the same during labor and birth by sort of gently and unobtrusively monitoring the progress and the health of the woman and the baby, making sure that, being a guardian for that process. And we can get into what happens if we go outside of that range of normal. But
well, it's interesting you use the term low risk, because mm-hmm. the first midwife I ever spoke with, she said, well, the dirty little secret in midwifery is 9 times out of 10, we show up at the woman's house and she delivers her own baby. And I thought, wow, that's fairly encouraging, and that so midwives are looking at birth as a natural process, something that your body knows how to do. I mean, not that you're not doing a lot, but mm-hmm. that from the perspective of the midwife, if everything goes well, it's a normal, there aren't really a lot of interventions that you have to do other than being with the woman and coaching her to go through. Would that sum it up fairly well?
Sure. I sort of think of the you know, like every time somebody goes walking in the woods and they don't get attacked by a bear, you don't see that on the front page, whereas a lot of the sort of sensationalized and Hollywood version of what birth looks like is kind of what's imprinted on us. But really what you don't see a lot is the woman breathing and the midwife, you know, sitting quietly in the corner. And that is a lot of the time what birth rooms look like. And sure, there are exciting moments and times for sure when it's appropriate for the midwife to help in some way, you know. But for the most part, I would say women always deliver their own babies. Midwives catch.
Right. Women, of, yeah, that's a yes, good difference in term. Right. I hear doctors saying deliver, but yeah, really you're there to receive the baby.
Right.
The woman's doing the work.
That's right.
So and it's another interesting point that you point out. I mean, a lot of what we see in television, you know, their Lifetime has an entire program or programs devoted to, you know, it's like birth 911. Right? So
yeah,
so we're sort of conditioned to have that sense around birth, and I can't tell you how many movies I've watched that have birth portrayed as, you know, as potentially life and death, which it can be, and it's a normal part of the process. I don't know how many people listening out there have seen a normal birth, and it's very different than what you might see in a hospital.
And I wanted to ask about that. What I've got a lot of questions, but one thing I wanted to ask you, if you can just describe, what does a typical home birth setting look like? Where is it happening? Is it happening? I've heard of bathtub births. Can you describe what the setting is like?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a reason why I really love home birth, and that is that I really am the guest in the woman's home. The power dynamic is quite different than sort of the dynamic where the woman gets in the car and goes somewhere and puts on someone else's clothes and sits on someone else's furniture and follows someone else's rules. I'm coming into their home as the guest, and so she can have her baby however and wherever she wants, and that can look a whole lot of different ways. You know, people gravitate a lot of the time towards their cave, their happy place in their home, which is often their bedroom. Or I really think we can learn a lot by looking at how animals give birth, which is that they find some quiet corner and they go and they want to be undisturbed and they do their process. And so I sort of follow the woman around wherever she happens to be wanting to end up. And sometimes she's planning to have a water birth, and that could be in the tub that's built into the house, or it could be that she's purchased or rented a birth pool, something inflatable, like a kiddie pool kind of. It could be on the bed. I have definitely had my handful of toilet births, and I've had a couple of kitchen births, and it can be anywhere. It can be anywhere in the home, but it's important, I think, for the woman to dictate the terms on which she's giving birth, and so that can look a whole lot of different ways.
And do you find that women who are choosing home birth are often they're choosing it because their moms did it, or because they've just decided this is the way they want to do it? Or is it something that they've had births another way and they want, you know, maybe they've had a birth center birth or a hospital birth? Like what's the average woman in the valley who's choosing, or, you know, in Anchorage or, you know, in Eagle River, who's choosing to do a home birth? How does that decision seem to get made?
Lots of different ways, I think. I mean, I think it's a really interesting question, and all kinds of different reasons can motivate a woman to choose to do that. A lot of very educated women who have, you know, been really looking at the research might arrive at that conclusion. Sometimes it's because they did have some event in their life in a hospital that was traumatic. Could have been a birth, it could have been something else, that there's a negative association with the hospital. It could be that, I would say it's rare that it's because they were born at home. I have had some women who were home born and now they're being home born, but more likely or more frequently, that's not the case. And I think it brings up a really interesting thought, which is that how we ourselves are born is really our first birth experience. And there's a deep imprinting that happens in that moment when we go through that and come into the world. And I think a lot of decision making for now, when we become adults and become pregnant and we're looking at what we want our birth setting and situation to be, I think a lot can be unconsciously driven from what that initial experience of our own birth was, and it's a fascinating topic. There's a lot of perinatal psychology research and about cellular imprinting, and just I think that the events in our lives, such as birth, that happen in a pre-verbal time in our life before we can really conceptualize what's happening and have words for what's happening, are deeply shaping to how we then feel about, well, birth for one thing, but also just the world and life. And so it's one reason that I'm really motivated to provide options for women to birth on their terms in a way that allows for a gentle passage for that baby, so that that can be what's laid down for that infant foundationally as an impression of what is life, what is the world, how did it feel to arrive here. So
you know, imagine that
questions.
Great. You know, I imagine that most women have an ideal. You know, there's something they're reaching for as an ideal birth. How close do you get to that? Do you see that happen within close proximity?
Interesting. Well, yeah, I don't. Boy, kind of. I think sometimes the answer to that might be that if we just think about life, and when we're, you know, we're all subject to life on life's terms. And so I think it's one of those things sometimes where it depends on what the expectations are going in, or what the driving motivations are for those things, or what fears might be pushing us around, or other unconscious things. And so every journey is so unique and particular to that woman. And I see it come out all kinds of different ways, where I would say, though, that birth always leaves us with a deep impression, one that, I mean, I've worked with elderly people that still remember all their birth experiences with, you know, down to the minute detail. It's very, it cuts very deep to the core of our being, I think, to lay ourselves vulnerable and give ourselves over to this process. And that can bring up all kinds of different things. And so it's a hard question to answer.
The surrender piece in there, I think, is interesting, because in any other endeavor, you know, I think that you know, the other only other thing is when we exit this world, you know, in death, you know, but in birth, there seems to be a point where it's surrender is what has to happen. And for somebody who is used to being in control and wanting things to happen a particular way, and no matter how great it is, like life, it's such a great metaphor for life, because birth does not happen the way that you want it to happen, and things do not necessarily, it doesn't mean that that's not a good birth, and you know, it's a good outcome if you have a, you know, a healthy, happy, or just a healthy child, but that piece of like the being open and really getting that, wow, there's something else in control here, and it's not me.
We all have a different relationship to that word surrender, right? Like for some, it evokes thoughts of peaceful, you know, serenity, and for some, sheer terror. Mm-hmm. So at some point during the birth process, like what I like to say is that the baby's birth is the moment when his or her face comes out into the air, and, you know, in the Spanish word for birth is dar la luz, which means brought to the light. And so that is an obvious moment. That is the baby's birth. But the woman's birth as a mother to that baby, what I witness is that occurs at that moment when she completely gives herself over to the process, which is an incredibly vulnerable thing to do. It is a heart-opening, cracking-open thing to do. And I think therein lies part of the answer to why do we have such fear about birth. There's a much bigger aspect of that question, too, that could be answered. But there is something about that, like you're saying, Sam, that what surrender means to us and what being vulnerable means to us. And so it's such a personal, unique, and ever-changing process.
Yeah, it always cracks me up a little bit now, you know, after knowing Stella for a long time and having assisted just at a few births and seeing that just how a lot of people, it's always interesting to me what people choose to do for their birth. I know I heard a midwife tell a story once about this woman who wanted to have a rave birth, and she wanted to have the birth in, you know, in the dark, in the pool, and everybody was wearing those like glow sticks and stuff with with rave music, you know. So that's one thing you can control. You can certainly control the music, but you don't really You know, so they you can create all sorts of things around you that you can control, but ultimately the actual process of the baby coming out is completely, in some ways it's just you laugh. It's sort of like there's some aspect to me of just the universe is just it's like hilarious that we think that we can control anything. I mean, that's been my experience in watching births and being present to births.
Right.
Yeah.
How has your experience birthing personally affected how the midwife that you are?
I think profoundly. I had my first baby in the hospital with an epidural. I actually had midwifery care, but transferred care right at the end. I saw a Chinese herbalist and a midwife throughout my pregnancy. But in the end, I for a multitude of reasons, ended up going into the hospital in labor and having an epiduralized birth, lying flat on my back.
And just say what an epidural is so people know.
Yeah, an epidural is it's like a spinal block, but it has a catheter where the medication is fed kind of continuously, and so you can be a spinal block lasts for a few hours, an epidural can last for days, and it numbs you from about the waist down or wherever the wherever it's placed in this epidural space of the spine. And so anyway, that's a pain medication that is commonly used in obstetric care in the hospital. So, you know, that was my first birth experience. It was a beautiful event. I fell deeply in love with my son, and that was the perfect birth for him. And I guess for me at that moment, I was 19 years old, and I definitely didn't know much about, well, anything. And then just a few years later, I had another son, and I had a midwife and a home birth with him. And that was definitely the perfect birth for that baby. And I think it's interesting to look at their personalities and to sort of ponder what that all means. But it really shaped me as a midwife. I did doula work for a while before I did midwifery work, and in conjunction with it, and it really helps me, I think, to be able to flex and to see. Really, while I'm a huge proponent of home birth, and I think it can be a very sweet experience for all involved, what is more important is that the woman chooses her birth setting and, sees herself as the authority over her body, her process, her choices, and feels like an active participant in her care. And so wherever that is, like a woman choosing this really, takes some deep soul searching, and I really encourage women to look into all their options and choose that which feels right all the way deep, deep down in their bones. And so whatever that means for that woman, and so long as it's on her terms. But yeah, I really appreciate that I've had both experiences so that I can really be with women in any setting that we might end up in.
I remember you sharing a piece about your birth, and that really intrigued me before I knew anything about midwifery, because I'd only really seen home births. I mean, not home, I'd only seen hospital births and only seen a lot of birth on TV or in the movies. And what you described was the midwife just sort of touching your hand gently, like to just get you to relax everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, I mean, that had me sort of move into learning about the Bradley birth method as opposed to the Lamaze method, which I'd known about, and just looking into all these different methods. And it really surprised me that the idea that, I mean, you got to let your uterus do the work.
Yeah.
And that it's such a strong muscle in the body, and all of this effort is going right there. And so your job in the midst of all of this, chaos that's going on in your body is to actually be able to relax. And so to me, that was huge to think about that. Whoa, like that, to think about that as being helpful to the process. I think, again, because of just what we talked about earlier, that wanting to control, but there's an element of tension around that. So what you're actually like to help with the birth, it's that letting go, that surrender piece.
Right. Yeah. Relaxation and breathing. And honestly, this is the really juicy, cool secret, is that what gets the baby in gets the baby out.
Uh-huh.
So actually, when a woman is in a really healthy, efficient labor pattern, she's, her body's doing what it was designed to do and things are going well, her hormonal blueprint is actually identical to when she is making love. Is that okay to say on the radio?
You can say that on the radio. I don't know if you're my, our engineer just perked up. He was looking at his iPhone, but all of a sudden we're like, uh-oh, did we get censored? Do we have our three-second delay?
Ready for the beep? But anyway, it's true. So, you know, there are different hormones that are at work, and those are the ones that really facilitate a great, you know, labor, in which oxytocin and endorphins and all that juicy stuff that helps us open and relax and have steady contractions, that's what facilitates it. The opposite of that is stress hormones, which is what will arise in a setting where a woman doesn't feel safe or is feeling too observed, too intruded upon. It will shut that labor down. Or it can. So I forget how we segued into that, but
Just about
the relaxation. Yeah, the relaxation. And so basically, I guess what I was going to get at is that what we want to create, and one reason why I see home as being such an ideal setting for somebody to have that set up, is that they feel inherently comfortable and at ease and in their own space and feeling, you know, at peace. And so those hormones are what get going. And yeah.
Well, this is why it's not a spectator sport. And
right.
I know I spoke with another midwife who, you know, she has people sometimes think that their whole family's going to be there to watch, you know, and mm-hmm. cheer them on, like, you know, like a cheerleading squad. And, you know, and what she often does is she sort of whisks the woman away and they go in the back room and have a baby, you know?
Right.
So it's not, I mean, the whole family can be there, and, you know, especially if there's other kids and they need care and, you know, breaks and stuff to help out. But having, you know, seven or eight sets of eyes on you while you're trying to labor is maybe not, I mean, unless you happen to be a rare person who, you know, likes to be on stage, you know.
Right.
That'd probably be how I would give birth if I did it. Because I have that streak that, you know, I like being on stage.
Exhibitionist.
So, yeah. If you're a little bit of an exhibitionist, maybe, but otherwise it might not be a good idea to have, you know, every single person that you know and love be in the room with you and cheering you on.
Yeah, you know, I've seen it go both ways. I've definitely been at some crowded births where it's a very festive atmosphere and everything goes great, but more often, I would say less is more, and I definitely encourage women to really think critically about who they're inviting to their birth and think about, especially if you've never done it before, you might want to keep it small. And I definitely can facilitate helping to clear a room out if I think that it's making things kind of slow down. I think I've heard one little saying, which is that you add an hour to the labor for every person that's there.
Wow.
And I've definitely started to go over to that side of thinking that that could be true. And just like everything with life and midwifery, as soon as you think there's a rule about anything, it's just kind of next thing that comes along will break that rule. So
sure.
Not making any steadfast promises. But it does seem like in order for there to be a calm atmosphere, less is more.
So let's talk about the options of, like, birth
sure.
in the valley, and
mm-hmm.
so what you're licensing in, like what you're licensed as a direct entry midwife, and how that differentiates you from a nurse midwife or
yeah.
an OBGYN.
And I wanted to just add to this. So I've read that for low-risk births compared to obstetricians, midwives offer lower maternity care costs, lower intervention rates, reduced mortality, morbidity as a result of fewer interventions and fewer recovery complications. Is that generally accepted
mm-hmm.
as true?
Yeah. I mean, it's generally not on the front page of the paper. But yes,
mm-hmm.
it is definitely the research, the evidence points to that.
Less is more.
Yeah. So there's different types of care providers for pregnancy. And we all are pretty familiar with the obstetrical model, the medical model, physician attended childbirth, which generally takes place in the hospital. And
hold on one sec. Did
yeah.
we put that video on our on the Facebook page or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, you did. Monty Python.
The Monty Python video. So that is the extreme example.
obviously,
you know, it's sarcastic making
yes.
fun of birth in the hospital, but pretty funny because, as anything, it's got a kernel of truth in it. So
sure.
definitely recommend watching that.
Right. And for some women, the hospital is going to be the most comfortable place in the place where they feel the safest and like they can really, you know, turn themselves over to the process, like I keep saying. That's one option, and it's definitely not the only option. And sometimes, even when we plan a home birth or an out-of-hospital birth, you know, we end up there. That can happen. So I really like to try to equalize or neutralize some of the there's a lot of like separation between two strong-minded camps of like for or against, or this is evil and that is good. And I really don't feel that way. I'm really, really grateful that the hospital exists and that that model of care exists. And what's true is that if you are in a low-risk kind of category and everything is just unfolding as normal in a healthy woman's life process, and now she's pregnant and having a baby, it's not a medical problem. Medical problems can arise just like any other time of life, and it's certainly a vulnerable time for that. But ultimately, it's a normal life process. And so for that percentage of women, which I want to say is something like 90% of women, if they go to the hospital,
That's 90% is the low risk. Just want to make that clear. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think I'm kind of making that up. Like, I've definitely heard that from time to time, that number bounced
around. That's the number I hear. It's about 90%. Yeah.
So when those women go to the hospital, the chances of them being intervened on is really high. And when childbirth is intervened on, you know, as opposed to a physiological birth that's just unfolding as it would, now we're messing with the time-space continuum and, you know, pushing the river, so to speak. Now, you know, the healthy woman having a normal life experience of childbirth goes into the hospital and starts receiving all these interventions. Now we're not going to see what that birth process would have been like if it were undisturbed and allowed to unfold.
Interventions can be something as simple as strapping a fetal monitor and not mm-hmm. allowing the woman to move around.
That's right.
Basically having her hold a particular position or not allowing her to have food and water because mm-hmm. she's basically running a marathon.
Or because maybe she might, in a worst case scenario, have to undergo surgery, in which case we don't. It's all thinking backwards from the worst possible disaster. So mm-hmm. if you had an emergency surgery, and you were to have eaten or had anything to drink, now you could aspirate on your food. So this is kind of how that all rolls downhill. But I really want to say again, I really appreciate the hospital, and I don't want to participate in any bashing of that model.
And we don't. We're absolutely like, thank God the hospital exists. Yeah. I will say it again. Thank God for that level of intervention, because there are things that we need it for. But it's, again, it's like the right tool for the right job.
And, in the right moment.
And there are things which we'll probably discuss in the second half of the show that can really only be handled appropriately in a hospital setting. And that's good. Mm-hmm. But I think the point that you're making really well is that most of the time, if those things are not necessary, why put a woman in the situation where you could be going down the road to interventions that aren't needed? But when it's very clear from the outset that interventions are needed, glad that there's some place mm-hmm. that can do it, right?
But we don't want to just look at it as that the hospital – like I just want to throw this out there, that sometimes what the hospital setting is saving a woman from, it also helped to create.
Correct.
That's the little, you know –
Yeah, and I think some of those are probably considerations of liability
that
they're trying to mediate.
Yeah, it's real easy to see how we've ended up there with the convergence of financial and insurance and, you know, litigation and then fear, of course. Yeah. Exactly. All these things collide.
CYA.
Well, we are going to take a break here in just a few minutes, or just in a few seconds, actually. And you're listening to Stella Lynn. We're talking about midwife care. And if you have questions for Stella Lynn, just type them on our Facebook page, Bridge to Everywhere on Facebook, and we'll answer them on the air. And we'll be back in just a few moments.
Community radio is what you make it. If you'd like to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, 89.5, Big Cabbage Radio, find us on radiofreepalmer.org. That's radiofreepalmer, one word, .org.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we're speaking with Stella Lynn, midwife in Palmer. She works out of the Kozlowski Center. And we are talking about all things about midwifery. And we were just in the middle of a conversation looking at what are the different options for women looking at having a birth in the Valley. And we just finished talking about an obstetrician. But we also want to get into the difference between somebody who would go see an obstetrician versus a nurse midwife versus what a direct entry midwife does, and talk about some of those distinctions. So go ahead.
Okay. So there's a couple of different kinds of midwives. Nurse midwives, or CNMs, certified nurse midwives, are practitioners who have gotten a nursing degree, and then they've added on to that with specialized midwifery education. And nurse midwives have a bit more latitude in terms of which women that they can care for. You know, direct entry midwives, which I'll get into this, care for low-risk women. Nurse midwives have a bit more latitude and some prescribing abilities that direct entry midwives don't have. Most often, nurse midwives will be able to have hospital privileges. They may work exclusively in the hospital setting, or they may work in a birth center, a freestanding birth center. They, in our area here, a lot of the birth centers do have a staff nurse midwife. So if you have the care, if you're planning an out-of-hospital birth with a nurse midwife, and then a transfer of care becomes necessary to the hospital, sometimes there is a bit more continuity where she can remain your care provider in the hospital. Nurse midwife, like I said, has a little more prescribing ability and a little more latitude. A lot of the birth centers here where there are nurse midwives and direct entry midwives working together, the women that are going to that birth center for their care may not really feel any particular difference between those practitioners. One might be writing a prescription, one might not. That's one route into midwifery. Another route is the direct entry midwife who enters midwifery directly, not through nursing school. There are many ways to even gain that credential. And typically, especially here in Alaska, what we have is the apprenticeship model of education, which is side by side with also some didactic learning, schooling. Me personally, I am an apprentice-trained midwife, and I did 5 years of apprenticing over a 15-year span. The last 3 years have been consecutive, and then the first 2 years were with my own midwife after my second child was born. Anyway, that's on-the-job training, and you're supervised by a senior midwife, and simultaneously, you know, getting your schooling in. I did mine through the Via Vita Midwifery Foundation, which is a state-approved educational program for midwives. And there is a governing board of direct entry midwives in Alaska. There, you know, this gets into a whole other subject, which is the legality of midwifery, which is different state by state. I think in about half the states, there is legal, you know, there are midwifery laws. Midwifery is legal and regulated. And then I think in the other half of the states, it's a mixture between being illegal, as in you will go to jail if you practice midwifery, and illegal, which is to say there's no regulating anything. There's no laws for or against, and therefore also you can't accept insurance or have any, parameters that you're working in. But here in Alaska, we have midwifery laws. There are statutes and regulations governing what we can and cannot do as direct entry midwives, and a board that gives us our licenses. And so satisfying those requirements, certain number of births that have to be attended, and other practical skills that you have to be checked off for by a senior midwife, and finishing the schooling aspect of it. And then, direct entry midwives can work in birth centers or practice just in home births or a combination of those things, and have no hospital privileges. But what I offer and what many other midwives offer is that if you are a client for a home birth, you know, planning a home birth, and a transfer becomes necessary, then my role doesn't disappear. It just shifts. And when we get to the hospital now, we're transferring care and trust to these other practitioners now, but I'm remaining and becoming a doula for that family, somebody that provides emotional and informational and physical support for the, you know, experience. That continuity, I think, is really nice for moms. They've developed a relationship with the midwife that's been walking along the whole journey with them. So that's nice for it.
And say more about disappear. Some people may not have heard that term before, doula. Mm-hmm. And I know Kevin likes to ask about the term doodla.
Right.
So we need to know what.
Speaking of the dudes, we really want to hear about men in this whole process.
Yeah, we haven't got there yet.
I want to hear about the men, and you know, do they get to have a say about the kind of? I mean, is this all just one direction what the woman wants, or is there actually, do you find a collaboration between the husband and the wife about what kind of birth they want together?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's as varied as what kind of relationships people are in. People birth in the context of their lives, and so whatever that looks like on a daily basis is going to just transfer into this conversation and then probably be amplified. So
if it's a democracy normally, then it's a democracy for the birth, and
sure.
If it's not, then it's not.
Sure. Or, I mean, it's like endless variations on that theme, but we definitely, as midwives, want to empower the fathers to be involved, sometimes catching their own babies or, you know, cutting the cord or whatever that looks like for that dad, and helping, you know, what I like to do in my work with families is to really see this as an opportunity where everything is kind of, you know, extra amplified, and this is a really charged opportunity for this couple to bond. Oxytocin is the hormone of bonding and love, and so we want to take full advantage of that. And so however I can facilitate bringing a dad in, maybe he's already there, but maybe he's a little bit chewing his fingernails in the corner, not sure, then facilitating that by, you know, showing him how to maybe press on the woman's back for some counter pressure relief, or, you know, encouraging a little eye contact, or some, maybe even me going out of the room, midwives going out of the room for them to cuddle together and have their own time. That can be a beautiful part of labor too. So that's like I say, as endlessly varied as relationships are. There are as many ways to birth as there are women, and as many different family dynamics as there are couples. So yeah, but doulas, a doula is somebody who doesn't hold any clinical responsibility for the client, but provides extra support, and often, especially working together prenatally with the family, you know, as a doula, providing education about what your different choices are, maybe helping to formulate a birth plan, and just sort of familiarizing oneself with the family's wishes and dreams and hopes and aspirations, and visiting concerns and fears and helping to work through that, and then providing a continuity of care throughout the whole labor and birth process. So a doula can work with a mom no matter where she's birthing. The woman has some other care provider, doctor or midwife, and the doula is just another asset and does not replace the importance of the father at all. Hopefully has that same mindfulness of, you know, serving the couple and the family. So, yeah.
So it's nice, so that you can, having experience working as a doula, that when there is a situation where there's a transfer that has to happen and a woman has to go into the hospital, that you can move into that role. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they've still got the person that they've worked with for the, you know, 9+ months who they trust, who can be in that relationship and also help, you know, run interference sometimes between, you know, that somebody who's, you know, maybe wasn't expecting to be in a hospital and has ended up there. So, you know, to kind of help people get to that place where, nope, this is actually what's needed and we're doing exactly the right thing, and, you know, and help advise on how the process is going to go forward.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That's great. So one thing I want to bring up, because that most people don't know that you do, is I want to talk about placenta encapsulation.
Oh.
That's a little sideways step, but I wanted to get that in there because
sure.
I think it's really important. A lot of women postpartum, that's after birth, are just completely exhausted. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time to build a baby. And, you know, even if it's your first baby and you didn't have other kids at home, it takes a huge amount of energy. And so one of the things that you can do actually is to put energy back in is to consume the placenta. And so I know that's like a little bit of, I just got a face from Mike on the engineering board again. He steps out and hears about people eating placentas. So we're going to talk a little bit about.
Can we do it in a larger context of the postpartum care that midwives offer, including breastfeeding support?
Right.
And
yeah, for sure. So, yeah, it's right. After the exertion of not only what it took to nourish that pregnancy, but then labor and birth, all that is energetically, it's a bit like summiting Denali in an evening. And so it leaves a woman in a somewhat deficient state, especially from the perspective of Chinese medicine. And so one option, if you look at most mammals, what happens is they birth their baby, they birth their placenta, they eat their placenta. and I know that for women, especially in our society, that's a little bit too visceral and maybe not so great for the not so agreeable to the palate. So one option is to take it as in capsule form. So what I offer families is to do that process for them of taking their placenta and turning it into capsules, which is I follow a recipe from traditional Chinese medicine of steaming it, dehydrating it, powdering it, and putting it into capsules. And so what I bring back to them is a bottle that looks just like vitamin pills. And I guess in China, you really can just walk into a pharmacy and buy placenta pills. I think they're from sheep and pigs and not humans. But it is seen as a tonic and blood building and energizing, vitality enhancing medicine. So crazy
as this. You lose quite a bit of blood. And you have to, how much does your blood volume go up when you're?
About 50% mm-hmm. blood volume expansion. So that's, the plasma that expands and the red blood cells are more dilute. But you do make a couple of extra cups of blood during pregnancy. And it's normal. It's considered normal to lose a couple of cups of blood during the birth process. Some women lose more. Some women have a real full-on hemorrhage and then have an even, more exhausting road back to rebuilding their health. And that can really help. And so the benefits, just in case you're wondering why on earth you'd want to do this, the benefits of placenta medicine include a healthier, healthier quantity supply, I guess, of breast milk and a quicker involution of the uterus. That means the uterus returning to its pre-pregnant state. And I think even most importantly, when you're pregnant, you're in a highly, you have high levels of progesterone, which is really feel-good hormone. And right after the birth, that really plummets, and then the prolactin, which is a weepy lactation hormone, spikes. And so there's a bit of a cliff that a lot of women feel like they go off of emotionally. We hear about the baby blues or even postpartum depression. And so the placenta medicine, it's a very unresearched area. But what I find the most meaningful is the feedback from women who've had multiple births and they have not done it. And now they're having a baby and they're doing the placenta encapsulation. They have something to compare it to. And across the board, I've heard nothing but, wow, that was a much easier postpartum period. I was way happier, not so depressed. My milk supply was better. And this is an interesting fact in case you're ever, at 35,000 feet in an airplane or something and somebody has a baby, let's just say, or there's some kind of a birth emergency where someone is bleeding too much. One thing that you can have that woman do is take a bite of her placenta, and that is an anti-hemorrhagic. It is an oxytocin treatment, so that means that it contracts the uterus down and staunches that bleeding. So in the same sense, when you ingest the placenta, you are helping to lessen the amount of postpartum bleeding. You're helping that uterus contract down more quickly. Postpartum or after the birth, I really like to talk about the fourth trimester of pregnancy. It's a terribly underserved and underestimated time of need for women, and I kind of liken it to, you know, maybe somebody's getting married and they're just thinking so much about the wedding. Like, it's all about the wedding, the wedding, the wedding. And then they have the wedding and then they realize what they were really having was a marriage. In the same way, it's all about the birth, the birth, the birth. And then, oh, now you have the baby. So it can be quite jolting and a huge transition. And between learning to breastfeed, which can be a learning curve for a lot of people and a tender time for everybody, it's also sadly a place where a lot of care just kind of falls away. And I think this is a real hallmark of midwifery care, is how much continued support there can be in the postpartum period. So what I offer and what most midwives offer is postpartum care. I come to the home on the 24-hour visit after the birth, and then again at 3 days, again at 1 week, and then 2 weeks, 4 weeks, and 6 weeks. And this is well baby care. This is, you know, monitoring how's everybody transitioning and healing and how's breastfeeding going. And again, just like all the way through from pregnancy and birth and beyond, it's just, you know, going in with the intention of let's just make sure we're in the range of normal, and anything that's not, then referring out, getting a consult. So just kind of, you know, that's what I see midwives as, are the guardians of the normal birth process. And normal is a very broad-ranging, you know, word or scenario. So.
And all that care is covered in what they pay you for the birth. So
yeah.
That's not an addition. It's not like,
right.
And we want the fourth trimester care. That comes
right.
in with
it. Right, it comes with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's good for people to know that Denali Kid Care, Medicaid, and many different kinds of insurance can be billed for home birth care or out-of-hospital care. So that's something, you know.
And how does that work, actually, if somebody's going to contract with you to be their midwife for birth? How does the payment work? Do they pay you a lump sum, or do they, if they're going to bill insurance, is it, how does that work?
So I do the billing, and if they have insurance, they just give me that information, and I take care of it, and any deductibles or copays are their responsibility, and sometimes there are things that their particular plan won't cover, but in general, you know, especially Medicaid and Denali Kid Care, all ultrasounds and lab work and everything are included. Now, for cash pay, people paying out of pocket, it's a greatly reduced rate, and there's a lump sum that they can make payments as they go, but have it paid by 37 weeks of pregnancy, or pay it all at once. And lab work and ultrasounds and things like that are charged in addition to that lump sum, but it's a greatly reduced rate.
Great. You're listening to Stella Lynn speaking about midwifery. And if you have any questions, we really would love for you to write them down on our Facebook page. Just type in Bridge to Everywhere and we'll answer them on the air. And I wanted to ask if are midwives trained to handle more difficult births and deliveries, like, say, twins or breech or posterior?
So in Alaska, the midwifery law is that direct entry midwives may not attend breech, twin, or VBAC cases. So breech is when the presenting part is not the head. In other words, it's not head down. It may be feet or bottom down. That's called a breech presentation, and we're not allowed to do those outside of the hospital. Same with twins. And then VBAC. VBAC stands for vaginal birth after cesarean. So the woman in that case has had a previous birth by cesarean and is pregnant again and wanting to have a vaginal birth this time. That's called a VBAC, and we're not allowed to do that, which, this is my personal opinion, is a crying shame. It's not an evidence-based decision. It's very complicated, and people should definitely let their legislators know.
Are there any
know.
Other states right now that mm-hmm. allow direct entry midwives to do VBACs?
Yes.
What states are they?
Well, the only other state that I'm very intimately familiar with their laws is Oregon, which is another place where I've practiced midwifery. And there you can do all of those things, as well as the other thing that we hit a wall with is if a woman goes to 42 weeks here in Alaska, then we may no longer attend her. In Oregon, that number of weeks is 43. So every state differs a little bit in their regulations. And then you asked about posterior. So posterior just means that if you can imagine that, let's just say the woman is laying on the bed and the baby comes out, a more common way for that baby to come out, the presentation would be called occiput anterior, which means that the baby's face would be facing the bed. That's an anterior presentation. That's much more common, but sometimes we have what we call sunny side up birth.
Stargazer.
Yeah, where the baby comes out facing the ceiling in that scenario. So that's perfectly fine. We can handle that at home, and we're allowed to do that at home. That's just a variation on the theme of head down. It is a little tougher a lot of the time as a delivery for that woman, because you have the hard part of the back of the head along the tailbone of the mom and sacrum of the mom. So it's a bigger journey.
That's where you can get potentially what a lot of women have referred to as back labor.
Yeah.
I've seen that as extremely, it can be, because it's bone on bone. There's not much you can do about it. So it's just something that you have to bear.
But sometimes, you know, we can really help with position changes and hydrotherapy and massage, and homeopathy too can help a baby to.
So say more about that.
Oh, I love homeopathy in labor and birth. It made a believer out of me, that's for sure, to the wonderful preceptor who primarily trained me is Susan Terwilliger from Alaska Birthing in Eagle River, wonderful midwife, and she's also a real whiz at homeopathy, although she'll tell you that she's a student of it.
But no, she's not.
But she uses a lot of it in her practice as well, and so I'm really lucky that I've picked that up along the way. I feel like my essential birth kit is a stethoscope, a box of gloves, and my homeopathy. Of course, we can say more about what does a midwife bring to a birth, which is
actually
a good question.
Let's talk about that since you brought up your own question.
Yeah, right. You asked this too, kind of, Kevin, like, what can we handle at home? And there, you know, we always hope for a real smooth outcome. Usually, if there's going to be a complication, what I would say is that you can see those train lights coming, usually. And so we would make a decision to go in sooner rather than later, if we thought that there was something coming up. If, you know, once in a while, a person can find themselves in the middle of a sudden emergency that wasn't anticipated, and midwives are trained to, you know, carry certification in neonatal resuscitation and IV therapy and CPR and basic life-sustaining techniques, so that while we were waiting, this is the difference between, this is what it kind of comes down to, the crux of it for a lot of people who are choosing their setting, they worry about this. And so what is true is that sometimes at home birth, if there was a complication, an emergency, where you lose precious time is waiting for EMS. That is true. So it's something that, you know, women should be informed about and make an informed decision about having a home birth, understanding what all the risks and benefits are. That's definitely on the risks side of the list. It's very, very rare to really have something, you know, so serious that we can't handle it, at least while we wait for emergency personnel. Things like hemorrhages or breathing issues in the infant, things like that, we are trained to handle. They are nothing that we wish for, and we work very hard to prevent them. I really want to emphasize that. We really work to prevent those issues. And what's in our toolbox, so the things that we carry to a birth, we do carry some drugs, including oxygen, Pitocin to be given as an intramuscular injection in the event of a hemorrhage, also methergine for the same reason. We have resuscitative equipment. We have other drugs like vitamin K, ophthalmic ointment, erythromycin for the baby's eyes if the parents choose that. We have Rogam to give prenatally and postpartum if necessary.
What's Rogam?
It's for Rh-negative women. That's a whole other conversation. Yep. But if the baby's blood type happens to be different than the mother's blood type, then this is a recommended shot that the woman is given. Also, we can suture first and second degree tears. Third and fourth degree tears, we have to go into the hospital for help with those. So we carry lidocaine and suturing materials. We have you know, a whole bunch of equipment in terms of all whatever our, like in my birth kit, lots of herbs, lots of homeopathy. We have all the, you know, paper products and plastic products that help protect the bed and not make a mess as much as possible.
I learned hydrogen peroxide is great for getting blood out of anything.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I'll have a woman order a birth kit, especially from a particular company. Just for some basic things like those Chucks pads and mattress covers and just some things, if you know, considerations for home births that you might need. And but yeah, we're really able to make a nice, tidy experience out of it.
And when you said, I just want to back up a little bit because you were talking about worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. Usually you can see the emergency coming a long way off. So you really wouldn't be calling EMS. You would be actually calmly getting the woman into a car mm-hmm. and taking the woman to a hospital, and you wouldn't necessarily need EMS. It's only when that emergency, the unintended emergency shows up, that's rare. So it's not like we're going from, like, you're not going from, oh, you know, everything is fine to, oh, got to call 911.
No.
In general, it would be like, this is going in a direction that I know it would be best to go to the hospital. So you're making that decision very early. You're not
waiting.
And
we're making it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody's taking anybody anywhere against their will. But the common reasons for transport are things like the labor stalling out. And we will have tried everything. We will have tried herbs, homeopathy, rest, exercise, hydration, nourishment, you know, all the we will have covered the bases. And if it truly is stalled out, then that's a reason to go to the hospital. There can be issues where, you know, what we're doing in labor is we're taking vital signs. That's how we know that we're in the range of normal. We're listening to fetal heart tones. And if we hear something or see something that doesn't feel right, we're going to talk about that. And, you know, fetal distress is a sign that, okay, home is no longer the best place to be. Meconium, where the baby has, you know, pooped inside the amniotic fluid, and now we're seeing that. That's a sign of fetal distress. Usually that would be an indication that baby had some stress somewhere along the way here and we should go in. But, you know, the parents have hired the midwife to bring her intuition and her experience and her expertise to the situation, just to help in determining are we okay, or should we go get some help? And most of the time, it's the first category where babies just come out, and it's quite a journey, but it's all as nature intended, and sometimes we do need to seek outside help.
How long will you go over a normal term before you might be concerned?
You mean like the passing of the due date and now? So, you know, it's a really great question. There's
And can you weave in there any of your favorite how do I induce labor things? Because I've been in this discussion for a long time, and I haven't heard anything that, you know, nobody's come up with the magic bullet yet.
It's always best to allow the baby to choose their own birthday. And a lot of the reasons why we have such an increase in the cesarean rate in this country is comes down to the fact that we've increased our rate of induction to such a degree. So, you know, really it's best if baby can choose their own birthday, and after we've passed the due date, I don't worry, you get to 41 weeks, you start having conversations. Term is 40 weeks, by the way. 41 weeks rolls around, start to have conversations, you start thinking about having a biophysical profile and a non-stress test, which are done by ultrasound. Just make sure, you know, the placenta has, like, only you know, short shelf life. It starts to sort of expire after a time. And so just making sure the placenta is functioning well and that baby seems happy, then going over is just fine. If you get to the point where there are signs that point to, you know, the risks of continuing this pregnancy are higher than the risks of inducing, then we can do some things at home to kind of push the river. There are herbs, pumping, you know, using a breast pump for that kind of stimulation helps to encourage oxytocin. The last ditch, there are homeopathic remedies too. The last ditch effort is often castor oil. But I really am not a huge proponent of all this. I feel like the best thing is to allow things to unfold as they would. And there are it's quite normal. There are plenty of women who go to 42 weeks and even beyond, and it's not a problem. It's a case-by-case basis that you have to look at it. And
legally, again, in Alaska, once you pass that, you have to go have a hospital birth. I mean, that's just what they have. That's just in the state that we're living in. That's the
unless
rule,
you
right?
choose mm-hmm. unassisted right. or mm-hmm. something yeah. else. And so that's another subject.
Well, we've got
down to the last minute. So we want you to just let folks know how they can contact you.
Oh, sure.
And any other last notes or comments?
Yeah, thank you. My phone number is 6545. My website is Holistic Midwifery. That's with a W, W-H-O-L-I-S-T-I-C, midwifery.com. And I'm located in the Kozlowski Building in Suite 217. And I just would really encourage pregnant mommies to do some deep soul searching and go with the options that feel right deep down in their bones. And I offer a free consultation if anybody's just wanting to learn a little bit more about what all those options are. So.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Stella. Have a wonderful evening, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.